In order to create a ghetto state that has some sort of less autonomy, when the world is unanimous on the Israel-Palestine conflict and has been for probably 40 years, the whole world regularly votes for Palestinian rights and against Israeli crimes. You know, and Canada, of course, has switched and is no longer voting, or we used to abstain mostly, but on these resolutions that regularly reaffirm the international community, the world community's take on elementary justice for Palestinians. And so Canada comes into this, again, out of the toolbox of foreign policy. Here's a chance to intervene in the Israel-Palestine conflict, whether it's justified or not, probably the most important, most significant political conflict in the world, and has been for however many years. Again, legitimacy can be debated about whether that is the case, whether that should be the case, but it is the case. It's the most covered conflict in the world. So here's Canada with an opportunity to intervene in this conflict in a way to create this, to legitimize, the key term is legitimize, this ghetto state. And how Canada has done that is by supporting the creation, whole cloth creation, of a Palestinian security force. And in doing so, began that process after the election of Hamas in Palestine in 2006. And at first, the goal wasn't to create a security force. It was to create a contra force. And I was living in Gaza when that contra force came about. My connection to this conflict isn't reading newspapers or interviewing Peter McKay or something like this. I was on the ground in Gaza with Hamas fighters who intercepted a weapons shipment from Canada and the US through Egypt in this conflict between Fatah and Hamas, where the goal was to wage a dirty war against the Hamas government so that the security forces of Mahmoud Abbas, previously Arafat, so that those security forces didn't switch sides and back the elected government. It'd be the equivalent of Harper losing this election, and then the entire RCMP and police forces and the Canadian forces saying, well, we don't recognize that election. We're actually still backing Harper. I mean, it's something so absurd in our narrative that we would never even, I mean, we would scoff at it. In Palestine, this was Canadian policy, to back an unelected regime, to create a situation where we were militarily attempting to overthrow a democratically elected government. And I lived that conflict in the Gaza Strip for 6 months of probably the craziest warfare that I experienced in a decade working in Palestine, because it was all small arms. It was in the densely populated Gaza City environment, or the refugee camp environment, and it was constant. And it was an attempt to militarily overthrow Hamas. This, I don't know who gave them their intelligence that the security forces of Abbas and Arafat were going to be able to overthrow the Qassam brigades of Hamas, because it was ridiculous on the ground. It was clear what was going to happen. And what Hamas did was actually quite disciplined in trying to figure out alternative ways to deal with what was essentially a terror campaign led by Canadian and American ally Mohamed Dahlan. To bomb internet cafes, to make it seem like Hamas was banning internet, like they were the Taliban or something like this. Kidnapping Hamas officials, imprisoning people, this kind of a dirty war, bombing, assassinations, ultimately culminating in Hamas saying, you know, enough is enough, and exerting the political and military prowess and advantage that they had on the ground in Gaza to expel Dahlan's forces. And, you know, literally, those forces, when it came down to the moment of clarity, those forces climbed over the wall in ghetto Gaza, climbed over the wall to get to Israel, and made panicked phone calls to Israel saying, they're coming to get us, help us, right? Because we're your ally, and the reason we're in this position, people were saying, is because we backed your strategy. And they literally chased them in their underwear out of the Gaza Strip. And that's how the story played out. And in fact, with the Palestine Papers that we just saw recently, Saeb Erekat, who is the one who had to resign because of the Palestine Papers, is quoted in the Palestine Papers saying to the Americans in 2007, we need to do something or else they're going to chase me across the bridge into Jordan. And so this was the real narrative. And so what did they do? The Israelis arrested the elected Hamas officials, parliamentarians, 45 of them, and put them in prison in Israel, and denied quorum to the parliament. So when the parliament was sitting like this, and these are each a seat in parliament of elected officials, well, there's 40, you know, Palestinians, you've probably seen it, put their political prisoners, they put photos of them on the chairs. So they had photos of the prisoners on the chairs, and then when it came time for the Canadian-backed government to create an interim government, and Salem Fayyad, the IMF World Bank character, stood up front and said, you know, who supports this? You know, and all the Fatah hands go up, all the Hamas guys are in jail, and they, oh, there you go, we got, you know, there's our interim government, there's our legitimacy for ousting the elected government. That's when Canada, who was the first to boycott Hamas, reinstituted funding to the Palestinian Authority. That's when Salem Fayyad, who got 2.5% of the popular vote in the election, holds two, his party holds two seats, in the Palestinian parliament, became the prime minister. That's when Peter MacKay started speaking out and saying, Salem Fayyad is this great leader, you know, he's this, you know, this was the project. The project was attempted to be militarily, and again, like I said at the beginning, it's about a toolbox. And in the toolbox, one of them is Contras to try to overthrow the government, and that didn't work. So now you try something different. And this, so now we turn it into the diplomatic playing field. We overthrow the government through some tricks of politics. And since that happened, since the elected government of Hamas was overthrown, there's been 450 laws passed by this unelected government through fiat, essentially, passed that fundamentally restructured civil society in Palestine. Because the part that needed to be, in order that, as I said, Arakat didn't get chased in his underwear into Jordan, that it was necessary to undermine Hamas's legitimacy in the West Bank and its popular support. So how do you do that when the military conflict was a bad idea in the West Bank, because a conflict between Fatah and Hamas underneath the eyes of the Israelis could have gone a number of different ways, and that would be potentially problematic. So they went to the toolbox and they pulled out restructuring of what Hamas calls their dawah, what we would call their social welfare apparatus, their hospitals, their schools, their support for the community, their community centers, and they attacked it. And for the past 5 years, with Canadian support, Canadian money, and more than half of the trainers, Canadians, in fact, the ones that are on the West Bank are not Americans in this project, they're Canadians. And that's through the fact that Congress has laws about interacting with terrorist groups. If you're an American official and you even speak to a terrorist group, this is illegal. And of course, as we know, shamefully, every single political formation in Palestine is a terrorist organization, every single political, legitimate political party within their society. So the Americans can't travel in the West Bank. So under this project, overseen by Keith Dayton, the goal of the project was to have Canadians, what Keith Dayton, the American general that's in charge of this, calls his road warriors. He says they're, Canadians are his eyes and ears on the ground, because Canadians don't mind traveling in the West Bank. They don't mind sleeping in barracks in Jenin and advising these troops. People will go on TV on a man on the street interview, you know, what do you think about this new political development? And somebody will say something, and if it's against the government, 3 hours later when they're sitting at home drinking tea, their door will get banged down and they get dragged off to jail. Journalists who have been employed for 15 years in Palestine, living through the most amazing things in the Intifada, surviving to defend their people journalistically and intellectually, people are being arrested because somebody will post a Facebook post and, you know, tag a bunch of names so that it comes up in someone's Facebook feed, and it comes up in this journalist's Facebook feed that there's a critique of Salem Fayyad's unelected government. And they'll arrest the journalist, put him in prison. This is a project that has completely undermined Hamas's entire social infrastructure in the West Bank, and it's spearheaded by Canada. It's Canada's second largest military deployment of what might surprise people, more than 20 individual Canadian expeditionary missions that Canada undertakes, I guess 21 now, that it takes part in abroad. Operation PRODIS. More than half of that project is Canadian. It's an American general that runs it. Keith Dayton has now left. It's now an Air Force general, Michael Mueller, who runs it. But more than half of the staff is Canadian. And Canada brags about it all the time. In fact, when they pulled a source of funding from UNRWA just a couple years back, they did it by traveling to the West Bank and saying, we are now switching our funding in accordance with Canadian values. And what they did was transfer that funding from the refugee agency into the security project. And the security project, that's seeded dollars going to overthrow a democratically elected government, to postpone elections, and to carry out a divide, which right now is a divide between Fatah and Hamas, which is preventing Palestinian political movements from coalescing. It's really it's a divide right down the middle of the Palestinian movement. And as I said, the connection with Egypt is that Egypt, as the linchpin for the American-Israeli-Canadian project in the Middle East, Egypt was the chief backer of the Abbas regime, both diplomatically, financially, and as we saw, militarily as well. Many of the attacks on the Gaza Strip, as the WikiLeaks and Palestine Papers documents show, was Egyptian intelligence working on the ground in Gaza, sending information to the Israelis about where to bomb or whatnot. Omar Suleiman, the man that Mubarak famously made the vice president during the uprising, Omar Suleiman's job was to mediate between Fatah and Hamas for reconciliation. And Omar Suleiman's job was to block reconciliation because Egypt didn't want a Hamas government. And so Suleiman's job was to make sure that reconciliation didn't happen. Reconciliation that was already dealt with by the Palestinians in their own way, which was in Palestine, the most significant political element is the prisons. And that's, I guess, a tribute to the Israeli occupation, whereby any significant political intellectual leader is in prison. I mean, actually, they're dead, right? I mean, assassination is usually the highest honor. The most significant political figures are assassinated. And if not, then they're put in jail. I mean, now in Bethlehem, the Israelis raid Bethlehem, you know, three or four times a week. And who they're arresting now in 2011 are kids. They're arresting 12, 13-year-old kids who, you know, they arrest a 13-year-old and hold them overnight and say, you know, who throws stones in your school or whatever? And if you don't tell us, we're going to take your dad's ID card away and he won't be able to work. And so the kid says, Muhammad, I think, threw stones, in whatever way they can get this intelligence. And then they go arrest Muhammad, and then they ask Muhammad, you know, who did you... And so now they're going through the 13-year-olds. But the only reason they're doing that is because they've already worked their way down a literal checklist. And so these political figures within Palestine that have the ability to negotiate, both negotiate a peace agreement, a settlement, but also to deal with internal rifts, they're gone. And in fact, the disengagement plan, the lead up to the removal in 2005, involved a very, very key component, which was preparing the political landscape in the Gaza ghetto, which involved the assassination, the high-profile assassinations of three senior Hamas leaders, including Sheikh Yassin, the spiritual leader of Hamas, and Abdulaziz Rantizi, who is agreed through the political spectrum in Palestine, considered, you know, one of the sagest political strategists and thinkers. The goal was to kill those people, and there was three failed attempts. They tried to kill five down the list of the senior leaders, and they were only able to get three of them. And that was to prepare the political landscape. Why? Because Israel knew that Hamas was going to take over in Gaza. And so the goal was to kill the most important political leadership so that you didn't give the Palestinians this possibility to create a small state with independence and to flourish potentially. So the goal was to deny that of Hamas through these assassinations, which then we see through the Fatah-Hamas conflict, were those leaders to be alive, were Rantizi and Yassin to be alive, it's unlikely there would have been the open warfare that there was, that ultimately it came to between Fatah and Hamas in 2007. And so you see the political initiative, the point of that prisoner story was to say the political initiative of unification of the Palestinian factions, reconciliation, was done by the Palestinian political movement. It's called the prisoner's document. People can check it out. It's a resolution negotiated from all of the 20 different Israeli prisons that hold Palestinians, and it was smuggled out in pieces of paper. They would write it up in prison, and then they would rip it up, put it into their mouths, and in visits, pass it, somehow be able to pass out the little chunks, and then outside of the prison, these chunks were reassembled, taped together. Literally, it's a true story. That is the Palestinian prisoner's document. It's this kind of political ingenuity of Palestinians that we want to be careful to never undermine by saying they're helpless or they're the weak party or something. You know, in trying to expose Israel, and its crimes, we have to be careful to not undermine the autonomy and the independence of Palestinians who are taking care of these matters on their own. Just like in Egypt, the people took care of the matters on their own. They didn't ask for a no-fly zone. They didn't ask for CETA aid. They didn't ask to have political programs funded to try to create democracy promotion. No, they just took the initiative and they did it. In Tunisia, there was no foreign help in Tunisia. The Tunisians took responsibility for the actions and they did it. In Oka, it was the Mohawks that took political initiative and did it on their own. That is where the most potent political action comes from within the communities. And so this prisoner's document is what Omar Suleiman, the Canadians, the Israelis, the Americans, were trying to undermine, because that document was for reconciliation. And in fact, on the street, in the Intifada, Fatah and Hamas and the PFLP, they all fight together on the street. The rift is a political rift that is affected by a type of warfare against one party in Palestine to the favor of another. The rank and file, there's not a hatred between people in Palestine on the street. The divide is a political tool. It's a divide and conquer tool that's being used. It's not as if Fatah and Hamas have a disagreement at some political level that they need to just get over. It's this open warfare that I described. It's a decade of rape and torture by Fatah, Palestinian Authority security forces against Hamas throughout the 1990s. But on the street, they work together. In the Palestinian social milieu, they work together. This divide is a function of Canadian policy in Palestine. And it's something that if you want, I said it's called Operation Protus. If people want to throw Operation Protus into Google, I'm not telling you some secret thing. You'll go to the page, it'll tell you 18 Canadians work, we give this much money, we're this proud of it. And every time McKay or a senior Canadian official goes to Israel, they talk about it. It's not a secret. In fact, they wish people would talk about it more because they're proud of this project. It's not a secret. It fits with this transformation of Canadian foreign policy that manifests itself in several different cases with the same toolbox. And this toolbox is the one we're going to deal with for the next generation. So it needs to be something as solidarity activists for Palestine that we're aware of. But also when something happens in Libya, we want to take this history and this understanding and apply it, because that's what the planners are doing, which is why something like Apartheid Week, it was actually the Israelis that say that the concern and that what we're trying to undermine is this increasing apartheid narrative. I've got a couple of quotes here that describe that. In fact, the Israelis were a year and a half ahead of some of my friends in Toronto who began Apartheid Week at the University of Toronto. Of course, to like a firestorm of criticism, how could you use this term, you know, it's anti-Semitic or whatever. The Israelis, as I said, Olmert talks about this in 2003, 2 years before this movement starts. And this is what Olmert said when he went to the Annapolis summit, which was one of these diplomatic arenas for negotiating peace. He said, on the airplane, he said, if the two-state solution collapses, Israel would face a South African-style struggle for equal voting rights, and as soon as that happens, the state of Israel is finished. Okay, so elementary liberal democracy in Israel means the state is finished in their conception. It's important to keep that in mind. Apartheid is the core of their political project, right? If they were to give the Palestinians the right to vote, if they were to give equal rights, that's the end of the state, according to the Prime Minister, on his way to a summit to negotiate peace. It's not like some, you know, smoky backroom interview after a couple of gins or something. This was when he went back to speak to the journalists on his flight on the way to this conference. Actually, it's funny because all these peace conferences get called photo ops, right? And Condoleezza Rice said about the Annapolis summit in 2007, she said, it's not a photo op, it's a little bit more than a photo op, she said. It's just one of these gold quotes. Israel runs every year a conference in Herzliya, which is the most important security conference that Israel runs. And in fact, Peter McKay has spoken there. And when people saw the Cairo's funding removed last year, when Kenny went abroad and said they were anti-Semitic, that was at the Herzliya conference. That's the most important strategic conference. This is what Barak said this year. He said, if there is one political entity between Jordan and the Mediterranean, it will either be non-Jewish or non-democratic. If Palestinians vote in elections, it's a binational state. If they don't vote, it's an apartheid state, right? And so this is where you see the intellectual disingenuity of someone like Michael Ignatieff, who in 2002, when he was flying over and looked down and said, this looks like an apartheid Bantustan. And in 2011 and 10 and 9, incidentally, he feels that the most important thing he can do is speak out against a lecture tour on a university campus as a university professor who was made rich by being a university professor, to speak out against this so that when he knocks on the door during elections and someone says to him, you know, what did you do about a lecture tour on campus? He can say, you know, I spoke out against Apartheid Week. Yet Barack, Olmert, Sharon, Livni, Netanyahu, they're putting the entire Israeli program into an apartheid narrative. And they're putting the entire state of Palestine into a ghetto narrative. So Canadian foreign policy and the creation of a ghetto state in Palestine is actually not some kind of extreme fringe of analysis. It's the core analysis, it's the anchor analysis that we'll deal with in the Israel-Palestine conflict for the next generation. Because when Netanyahu says that he wants a provisional Palestinian state, as we saw, the reason they want a provisional Palestinian state is because it's already encircled by the wall, which is finished virtually, and they want a provisional Palestinian state because they don't want to have Palestinians vote an election, because that would be the end of their state. And if they don't vote, then it's an apartheid state. So in order to prepare the landscape to deny the apartheid narrative, they're creating a ghetto state. And Canada is at the linchpin of this program. In fact, they're the lead of this program. They're proud of it, and it fits within their entire foreign policy transformation, which takes place and has examples and expressions in Haiti, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and now in Libya. So that was essentially what I wanted to say. I wanted to frame this in terms of a structural program so that we as a movement don't deal with each conflict with a clean slate as if it's something completely different, but we deal with this as the planners of these projects are, as Sharon and Olmert and Netanyahu, as Harper, McKay, and Hillier are doing. That is, as the core of the foreign policy apparatus as it's expressed in Palestine. So, thanks for having me.